This episode of Creativity in Captivity is sponsored by the Curtis Theater in Brea, California, presenting Don Reed's The Never Too Late Show on Saturday, May 11th. Tickets are available at the Curtis Theater website. Get ready for insight and inspiration on the creative process from an array of artists, writers, and visionaries on May 9th, when Season 7 of Creativity in Captivity kicks off. In the meantime, please enjoy over 150 episodes hosted by Pat Hazel with a stable of creative guests in our listening lounge at creativityincaptivity.fun.
This is Creativity in Captivity, and I'm Pat Hazel. My guest today is a world-class photographer, a director, National Geographic explorer, and TED speaker, whose work has appeared in Vanity Fair, Time, Fortune, Sports Illustrated, and National Geographic, as well as campaigns for Netflix, American Express, IBM, and Rolex. His photographs appear in the collections of the Houston Museum of Fine Arts, Museum of the City of New York City, and the Dow Jones Collection. Joining me now is award-winning image maker, picture taker, and visual storyteller, Stephen Wilkes.
That spark of electricity, a skipping stone that sets you free, or captive to a mystery, the curse of creativity. La 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 la.
Thank you so much for that kind introduction.
I feel like it's not even remotely enough to describe the artistry that you have in photography, because your images are extraordinary and iconic, and you seem to know exactly where to be behind that camera wherever you look.
You know, very kind of you to say that. I've always said that I feel like I have a blessed life in a way. I got to do the thing that I love most in life at a very early age, and I think when that happens to you, it makes you feel a certain way, and you just don't want to do anything else. And that happened for me, and it became my life's work. So I started taking pictures when I was 12 years old. So it's been a journey.
Wow. And what do you remember that first camera you were given?
Yeah, actually, I do. It was a Mamiya Seikor 500 DTL. I remember because I was so excited, my father brought it home for me. And I remember how I had up until that point been Instamatic type stuff. And so to finally have what they called an SLR, where I could look through a viewfinder and see something the way I was seeing it with my eye, was very, very exciting and very transformative. So I think, you know, for my dad, who was a businessman, who's, you know, really self-made businessman, he was an artist himself in many ways. And, you know, in the early days, obviously, when you're in the 1940s and stuff, the idea of being an artist was not a career. My father ended up going and starting his own business, but I think he had a connection to the fact that I was seeing things, even though he didn't think it was a career choice. He made it very clear it was definitely not a career choice. So,
is your dad still around?
No, unfortunately, he isn't. I think one of the great gifts for me in my life has been that I think as an artist, there's got to be somewhat of a struggle for you to raise to certain levels and heights in your own work. And that struggle for me was very early on. I had to sort of establish that this was not a passing, you know, whimsy. The idea for me to be a photographer, to be a creative, was something I just wanted to do. And even though my father kept saying to me, you're never going to make a living, you're going to starve to death, it's not a career, it's a hobby, I developed a fortitude, I think. So the more he told me I couldn't do it, the more I kept saying, watch me, I'm going to do it.
I think there's something about that, even if it's subconscious, that you're going to prove them wrong and or at least make them understand what it is. So he obviously saw your success before he passed. So did he have a favorite image? You know, having given you that camera that made such an impact on you, do you remember images that he fawned over later on?
Well, I'll share one story that gives you, I think, a little bit of an insight. I think, you know, as a child who had this sort of dynamic relationship with a parent, my father, so like I said, most of my life, he kept telling me, you know, never going to make a living. And then, you know, when I would come home with a picture I do, he would grab a magazine. He goes, how come your pictures aren't in this magazine? You know, it always was, you know, whatever I did, it wasn't quite, you know, as much as I should be doing, you know. And so, but fast forward, my father is about 90 years old, and he's in a assisted living facility. And he has a friend there that he's a lovely woman who he became friendly with. And my dad's memory, he was having memory issues at that moment. And she came to me right away and she says, Stephen, you must sit down. I have to tell you what your father said to me today. Your father said to me, you know, Libby, that was her name. She was a beautiful person. He said, you know, Libby, I used to tell Stephen every day, don't be a photographer. Don't be a photographer. You're never going to make a living. You're never going to make a living. Can you imagine if he'd listened to me, what a loss that would have been?
That, what a gift to hear that.
What a gift she gave me to share that with me. Even when you think there's a side of a generation where they looks like an impenetrable wall, to know that my father at 90 years old finally saw me for what I was just a wonderful, wonderful gift that I was able to really cherish, and I still cherish it.
And here's what's interesting to me, because obviously this podcast is sort of dedicated to people who do ordinary things. They've found something they're passionate about. Creativity is kind of a general catch-all, but the nature of it is we are all storytellers in some fashion, through visual art, through plays, through songs. And I think it takes people who are not thinking as storytellers, they're kind of rule followers, you know, graduate at this time, go to this place, get that job, have those kids. Like, their life is laid out by maybe a template that is expected from parents or families or higher education. And so to be anybody that reaches out to say, I want to pursue whimsy, or I want to amplify someone else's story, is really hard until it hits them emotionally, until they're sitting in that theater and they see their son or daughter singing that aria, whatever it is. Sometimes it gives them the feels, and then they, through seeing the audience see it, somehow it translates. You have so many beautiful, beautiful photographs, but you are more than a photographer. I can tell that in your book, Day to Night, which I had Amazon Prime ship me quickly, I tell you, it is the amount of color imagery of places all over the world. What I'm seeing not only is the beautiful photographs, but I'm seeing you as a storyteller in these exotic locations and in these humble places and in these very strange, you know, locations, thinking, okay, he didn't just snap one picture here. In Day to Night, there are these stunning sort of composites of landscapes that have human and animal narratives combined. And I don't know, but tell me, in the average photograph there, how many images are you shooting to show that transition from day to night?
Well, you know, Day to Night is really a body of work I created about 14 years ago, believe it or not. I've been doing this series. I like to describe it as a synthesis of all the aspects of photography that I love. So, you know, I started as a street photographer. My work evolved, and I started shooting architecture, landscapes, wildlife, all these different things as I continue to evolve as a photographer. But there was one thread that was through everything that I do, and that is I always was fascinated with time and history. In the year 2000, digital photography became suddenly this reality where in 2003, they suddenly gave us a camera that we could shoot that was the size of a 35 millimeter, but it could deliver image quality like a large format camera. And when that started to happen, I really started to look at digital. And in an interesting way, Day to Night was really born by the idea that this new tool was invented. And it was at a moment in time, if you think about the history of photography, where in the early 2000s, people were saying that photography was essentially dead. It was like everything was going to go to video. Video was the way people dream. Video this, video that. And I took a lot of offense to that. And I thought, well, wait a second. We have this new tool, digital photography. And then this idea of being able to, you know, take hundreds, thousands of images, be able to see them instantly, be able to then take them. And they invented this thing called Photoshop. And suddenly you could merge imagery together. And suddenly my brain was wired in a way where I started to think about, well, why do I want to go out with this new technology and shoot the same pictures that I've been shooting with film? Because I started as an analog photographer. I had mastered 4x5, 8x10. I always say that I'm blessed. I came into the medium at the perfect time because I got the best and really had to develop a mastery in analog, but also had to master a new technology, digital. And so the combination of those two things really, I think, wired my brain in a different way. And when you have an analog experience and you have developed a mastery in digital, you start to think creatively differently. And so for me, I wanted to create a new way of seeing with this new technology and to create photographs that I could never do with film. That's really where Day to Night came about, and I've always been drawn to time. You know, when you think about the whole creative process, I always like to say, it's about a spark. You know, it's not unlike, you know, if you're a Boy Scout and you're the one who has to start the fire. Some people are really good at that, right? They can get it going right away. And that idea of a spark for me is transformative, because not only does it start with where my own personal ideas and vision comes from, but also part of being a successful creative is being able to take your spark and spark others with it. And so the idea of collaborating is a very, very important aspect, I think, in anybody's work. And in fact, I've heard Yo-Yo Ma speak about this, his Silk Road project, how that was the thread that built it, was his ability to spark all these different people from all over the world into this idea. And I've always felt that that's something that never gets spoken about enough in the creative field, is the idea of your personal passions, your vision of something, how that gets translated is so important. And for me, Day to Night came about because I had this spark of an idea, and then I was lucky enough to come to fruition because of the technology that suddenly opened in front of me, and then willing to sort of take the dive and jump into a space which, honestly, many people, I remember the descriptions of digital photography in the beginning. If you had taken the word digital and changed it to color, and I could show you writings from the turn of the century that were done in the advent of color photography, they described it as being fake, that it wasn't real, it wasn't photography, yada, yada, yada. That is exactly the way a lot of the visual artists in the world were feeling about digital at that moment. But of course, you know, things change. People's perspectives change once they begin to realize that this is a new and an incredible tool that allows you to really, I think, access your mind's eye. And that became really the thread for me.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, I can probably articulate now, having listened to you, that when I look at each of these pictures, it's a little more like music. Your fascination with time is that this book is a symphony of light from dusk to dawn, because there's a temperature in the picture that makes me feel how people behave in the daylight. And there's just so much going on in that one image.
No, you've hit it with that, Pat. That's, to be honest, my children are both creatives. My son is actually a brilliant jazz bass player. And when he saw Day to Night, he looked at it and he said, "Dad, Day to Night is your symphony. That's a symphony." I've been working on another body of work. It's called Tapestries, where I do multiple exposures in camera. And it's all done over a fractional time. So it's like 4 to 8 seconds. I literally move my eye the way, you know, rapid eye movement, the way you come to a place and you look at a scene. And so these images all happen almost instantaneously. And he says, "Tapestries is like jazz to you." He goes, "But Day to Night is like a symphony."
And by the way, I want to let the listener know that Tapestries series can be seen on your website, which is stephenwilkes.com. You have so many great portfolios in there. The Ellis Island stuff was really unbelievable, which was sort of the decrepit hospital from Ellis Island. Like, there's a shot of paint peeling off the wall with a light switch that looks like aerial photography over tundra.
Isn't that kind of wonderful when you see something and you see something else and then you realize what you're looking at? I mean, that sort of relationship is something that I just love. I love this idea of being able to look at something and have it almost, you know, transform you in a way where you believe you're above it, you're above something, looking down on something, and then you realize, oh my God, that's actually paint peeling on a wall.
If that light switch wasn't there, I would say that was an ice flow somewhere.
Ellis was a really defining moment for me as an artist and a photographer, I think. It was the first time I'd ever gone out and shot architectural photography. And I had just really gotten the craft involved in mastering a 4x5 camera. And so I always say that as a photographer, in any creative endeavor that you do, I think, whether you're a musician, a painter, something may come into your orbit. And the hope is always that you're technically at a point where you can deliver on what you're actually seeing, what you're actually feeling. You know, there's so many times that people will say, "Oh man, I wish I could go back and do that now, because, you know, I'm so much better technically. I was, you know, I could play better, I can hear better, I can do all those things differently." I was very lucky when Ellis came to me. I was in a really good place in terms of that, and so it enabled me to tell this story of this incredible history that's on that island. It was abandoned, obviously, in 1954. It was the original infectious disease hospital on the island. So everybody who came in there who basically was brought into Ellis Island. If you had any kind of infectious disease, you were basically held over into the hospital until you got better. And so I was fortunate enough to be able to document that place over a five-year period. And we actually raised almost $6.5 million to stabilize it as a living ruin. And I think for me, what was so extraordinary was I went in with this idea I'm going to be shooting empty rooms and architecture. And it was this magnificent light because you're on an island. It has this intense color because everything was lead paint. So the depth and the richness of the color. And it feels like you're having, like I said, an elevated consciousness almost when you walk through those rooms.
It's also a very deeply emotional journey through a place that 12 million people pass through to come to America. And I mean, it's just so, to me, it's so interesting to see the locations. You know, in a weird way, you've documented your mind's eye for so many people of so many moments in your life. We can track you almost like a GPS by looking at this book.
You've hit on something I think that's really interesting. I think when I created that work, I had a direct connection to that place. I always tell young artists, young photographers, try to find something that connects to you personally. You know, if you're going to create work, if it's from your heart, then it changes and it feels differently than something that is where you're solving someone else's problem. When I did Ellis, it came into my orbit, but there was something else that was part of it, and that was my mother. My mother was a Holocaust survivor, and she actually came to Ellis Island as a nine-year-old girl with, you know, nothing in her hands, no parents, no one with her, except she had a teddy bear that was sewn together, and all of her family belongings, you know, notes, everything that they had was sewn into this teddy bear. My mother sat on the docks there for 5 hours before she was finally reunited with my aunt and uncle. I feel like there was a connection for me because of my mom, because of her childhood. I connected almost with the children that were on that island. And in the infectious disease hospital, that was a very, very powerful part of its story. There were almost 1,500 people died on that island, and many of them were young children. So it has a beautiful history. It also has some very dark moments historically. And I think one of the things that started to happen when I made these pictures of empty rooms was I started to feel the history and the light in these rooms. And in a way, you know, I said I started as a street photographer, but the reality is that when you are on the street, you read energy, you can feel people, you can feel emotion. I could walk up to you, not even say anything to you, Pat, and I could just look at you and tell that you'd be open to me photographing you, or that I shouldn't even pick up the camera because I'm sensing your uneasiness. And that instinct is something that's honed and developed, and it's like you're like a hunter. And I did that long enough that I had this kind of secondary sense about myself. But when I started walking into these empty rooms on this island, I started feeling that kind of energy. And so certain rooms were very open and certain rooms weren't open. When I started making the first few photographs, I remember there was this breakthrough moment where I made this one picture, and it was a shoe on a table. And the moment I discovered the photograph was the exact perfect moment. Literally, the light only hits this table 5 minutes a day. That's the exact moment I witnessed and discovered it. You know, when those things begin to coalesce and come together as a visual artist, you know, I always say it's like you're open to the universe. You allow yourself to see and feel everything. Everything started to change for me. I started to have this experience where creatively, normally when I go out and take a picture, sometimes you see it and it's perfect and you shoot it. Other times you go, this is a great spot. I want to come back in the morning because the sun's going to be over my head. In Ellis, it never worked that way. It was always the act of photographing and discovery were simultaneous. And that was very, very different for me artistically. I never experienced anything like that. But then there was this subtext to all the work, which I started to see as I started to continue to shoot. And that was, there was this sense of human energy that were in these photographs. Almost like people have told me, they look at my photographs and they feel their ancestors in my work.
We'll go back to your fascination with time. Now, digital has given you a chance to shoot a lot more photographs, but thinking back to prior to digital, it's kind of like being a bow hunter. To see that moment of that photograph literally between a quarter of a second and a quarter of a second after, a photographer of your experience you know it. Like, you see it and you take that picture and you know you hit a bullseye. I can only equate it to Alfred Eisenstadt's photography. The La Scala in Milan is this picture of a young woman on a balcony. I was fascinated by it so many years ago when I thought it was affordable. It was about $4,000 30 years ago or whenever, but it was out of my reach at that time. I ended up getting some version of it. There was a film strip, and this kind of fascinating about timing. It was a picture of the developed film strip that showed the shot before, the big moment, and the after. And I will tell you, even though that was now something I could afford, it also told me how critical a blip of a second. And it's just unbelievable how many times for a really good photographer, you probably viscerally feel that image on your own brain as you're looking through the camera.
When you look at a photographer's film, and you know, I touch on this in the film, my documentary on my mentor, Jay Mazel. And with Jay, you know, I used to set up his film as a 19-year-old kid, and I would look at every single picture. And you learn, when you look at a photographer's film like that, you see how their brain works, you see how they're thinking. You know, you're literally seeing his visual cortex in action. And it's kind of an incredible thing to witness. To your point, this idea of knowing when the moment is, I think that's where the mind's eye is. And I think when you shoot for 5 decades, and it's like breathing, it's like blinking, it is like an involuntary act. But I just stay open, and then I see the image before I ever pick up the camera. It is literally like that. And so the camera is just a vehicle for me at this point. And, you know, I don't say that lightly. I say it because I've been doing it for over 5 decades. And when you do something that long, something happens to you.
Well, you develop this instinct, and it's not luck. The great candid photographers are people that I've worked with over the years on projects. They also are stealth in a way. They know how to be present but not intrude or not change the dynamic or not ask people to pose.
That stealth aspect is a very interesting thing. I'm very good friends with Jim Nockway, the wonderful, incredible war photographer. And Jim said something to me that just always resonates with me. He said, you know, when you go into a scene, a place where so much pain is going on, he tries to visualize like he's walking through water, dead calm water, and you can see clouds reflecting and he walks around the clouds. That's kind of the way he sees himself. It's as if he has this innate ability. And I think, you know, any really good street photographer that way is really refined at that art, understands the energy that he's around or she's around, and is able to sort of become invisible, essentially. That's the gift. You know, you have to be able to get close enough, but also you have to project a certain energy that allows you to get that close. I see it too in the wildlife work that I've been lucky enough to do. I'm in their den, I'm in their living room while they're eating. You know, I'm just, who's this guy? You know, I'm on a scaffolding for 36 hours taking pictures. But you know, I allow myself to be just open and put out a certain kind of energy. I think with the wildlife and what I've discovered over time is everything is connected. And so the more you understand that connection and understand the energy and the flow of energy that goes through all of these different things, it really affects your way you see things, and affects the way you have a certain level of consciousness that changes. And I've really seen that in my work over the last few years as I've been more and more focused on endangered species and habitats. That's something I've been documenting for the last 5 years now. I've been doing a project in Canada. And the one of the interesting aspects of that work is, you know, I go to these very, very remote places, places that frankly, a lot of the wildlife that I'm seeing are not exposed to human beings very often, if ever. You know, I sit in a single place and I look at a single scene for 36 hours. I mean, there's scientists that don't do that.
That's funny. I forgot that it's not like you set up a camera and it's running overnight. You are actually present.
Exactly. No, and I'm glad you said that, because I think when people look at day to night, there's an assumption that I'm doing something technically like running a time-lapse camera. That's definitely not it. It is literally me hand-cocking a lens just the way like Ansel Adams did, and you know, Carlton Watkins and all my heroes worked. And that is that they saw something with their eye, and they took a single photograph. I take a single photograph, I capture the photograph with a digital back. It's so the actual process of what I do is as traditional as any of the early masters. But what's radically different is what happens at the end of the equation. The backside of what I do is where I take this concept of time. What I created, the concept is called day to night, obviously, but what it's based on are time vectors. So if you look at a two-dimensional still photograph, in my work, it looks almost like it's three-dimensional because I change time through vectors. One could be a Y axis, which is up and down. Sometimes it's across the image, left to right, that's the X axis. And sometimes it's a Z axis, which is literally on a diagonal. And when you are able to create a seamless image, merging specific moments based on where they were in time, the color of light changes, all of these things begin to happen, and it creates a depth and a perception that for me is really exciting. And I think it's, you know, I think the medium of photography is just going to eventually get to a place where we look at a photograph, it's going to look like we're looking at a window. You know, I think it's going to begin to have that kind of a visceral experience.
I'm glad you described the various axes, because I noticed in the pictures as I was going through that sometimes you might use the horizon line because that makes the most sense in the storytelling. But other times I thought, this is really interesting how this is sweeping almost like a watercolor from this side to that. Or because something behavioral is happening in the daytime where human beings are there, you opt to keep them in. But if you wouldn't have just described that, it wouldn't have been so clear to me the decisions that you're making about where to choose that light change.
I think the hardest thing about what I do is it's the idea of creating a visual harmony between night and day. If you look about art, they say the two strongest colors are white and black. They're going to demand your attention visually. And so one of the unique aspects of what I try to do is I'm not only thinking about the narrative storytelling, which is critical in my photographs. I have to be present because no matter what I do a lot of planning before I make these photographs. We have to get all kinds of special permissions. Sometimes I'm shooting from cranes in the middle of the city, or sometimes I'm in the middle of Lake Bogoria in Nairobi on a 30-foot tower. And I spend 36 hours in these places and photograph. But what I'm thinking about is I'm thinking about the story that I'm witnessing with my eyes, and I never know what's going to happen. So I do all the planning, and then what I always say to people is you just got to be present, and you got to be open, and you got to stay positive, and then things come into your orbit. Magic things happen, and I don't know really other way to describe it. My assistants like to describe me as having a halo on my head, but I just think sometimes the more I practice, the luckier I get.
Well, I think in a weird way, you're taking dictation for nature, because those 36 hours, it's telling you the story. And then what you get to choose is what's that visual handshake between dusk and dawn? Where are they coming together in a place that the viewer, which ultimately you as a storyteller choose, is the most impactful? Now, that book has been reissued. So what happened when you were rebuilding it? Did it change in size or scope, or did you add more photographs?
Well, originally when the book had been done, I've been doing the project for 10 years. And so subsequently, the new edition came out just this last year. So it was almost now 14 years. So I had created a whole expanded body of work. My wildlife work started to really expand, the Canadian project that I've been working on for National Geographic Society. And then COVID hit. I saw COVID as this moment too, like, one of my heroes, Jan Brueghel, the elder, and Peter, his son, they were really extraordinary artists, you know, in the 1500s. And Peter was the one who actually documented the Black Plague. And I remember studying his paintings as a kid, and I would see the only visualization we have of what that period looked like are his paintings. I mean, they're so extraordinary because he was such a master at detail and scale, and he would show the magnitude of what was happening. And it always hit me in a powerful way that he would take the risk and go out and do this, even though that this was this deadly disease. And I'm sure everybody was feeling very much the way we all felt during the beginning months of COVID. But as an artist, he went out and told that story. And I felt it was really important that I also do that. And so as things began to unfold, I started to look for opportunities where I could, you know, capture a major historical event during the moment of COVID.
And I will tell you that those mask portraits are a major moment in time. And the aerial photography that you do in COVID-19 as well, it's scope, like it's the big picture. And then those mask portraits, that's the face-to-face contact with regular human beings in their workplace. There's a lot of empathy in that, in those photographs.
Well, you know, one of the things I wanted to do, Pat, I got a phone call from Vanity Fair, and they said, show us what your life is like right now, like me do pictures of my house and, you know, what I'm doing, you know, living basically in captivity. And I said, you know, I don't really want to do that. I said, but I'll tell you what I'd like to do. I said, I'd like to do a series of photographs of all the people who are making a difference in my life and all my neighbors' lives right now. The guy who's opened the deli up and has all his workers there. The local doctor who's, you know, in charge of the local hospital dealing with all the COVID patients. I said, I want to go out and shoot those people. You know, these people were going out, doing their jobs, going to work, and potentially exposing themselves to the virus and bringing it home to their families. What I wanted to do was, I wanted to create these powerful portraits, but to make sure that everybody saw that this, with their masks on, this is the moment in time. This is what they're thinking about. This is what they're doing. And I remember they couldn't believe that I was out there wanting to shoot them. Like, I remember how humble they all were, how they were. They thought I was taking this huge risk in doing this. And I thought, no, this is so important. These are my local heroes. And so that was the beginning of where I started that journey. And then subsequently, I did two day to nights. I photographed a commitment march in Washington, D.C., right after George Floyd had been murdered, 50 years to the day when Dr. King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. That was an extraordinary moment and time to bear witness to, but to photograph was really something. Even Miami Beach during the height of the pandemic, I shot Halloween during a full moon when Ocean Drive was literally closed from cars and you had everybody walking the streets in full costume during COVID. I mean, it was crazy.
I want to turn the page to the most emotional material that I saw, only because I was living down in Mandeville, Louisiana, was your photographic study of Hurricane Katrina. And I don't know how much time you spent down there, but we were just blocks from the lake on Mandeville side of Lake Pontchartrain. It was a very interesting time to be down there and to see how much loss. And I had a friend take some pictures that he sent me of refrigerators that were up in trees, because the water had these refrigerators floating, and then when the water receded, they were left up in the tree. It was such a strange puzzle.
My first experience with Katrina was about 6 months after the actual hurricane. And one of my motivation to do it 6 months was because the story had moved on already. People were, you know, thinking, they've got their money, they're going to get rebuilt or whatever. You know what I mean? People move on, next story, whatever. And I just wanted to see really what was still happening down there. And it was just an extraordinary experience. I went to an area called Holy Cross, and I was working with the World Monument Fund. And they were trying to save some of these classic old New Orleans row houses that are built, you know, these very long houses that are just amazing historically. And so they said, listen, if you're going to go down there, well, maybe we could do something together. So I said, yeah, I want to tell the story, but I just don't want to tell the story about the houses. I said, I want to tell the story about the people. And so I went to a public town hall meeting, and it was there that I got to meet all these people who not only survived the hurricane, lived in their houses as it was happening, if you can believe this. They didn't abandon their properties, but were rebuilding their own properties by themselves. And at 6 months, still had no federal aid or assistance. It is unbelievable. And so I did these portraits of these individuals. And then 10 years later, Pat, I went back to see how their lives had changed. And so, and that was part of an exhibition I did in Los Angeles. I remember going back and one woman, this woman, Patsy, who I'd photographed in Holy Cross, she was a beautiful woman. She just lived outside of her house, and her and her brother were rebuilding the house and living in it. And I remember it was like there was no insulation. They had to strip everything from, you know, from all the mold and everything. And she was sitting outside, and she was air drying her laundry, and I did this portrait of her, and she's got this great big smile. And she was just so optimistic. And then I came back 10 years later, and nothing had changed there. You know, the schoolyard across the street was still abandoned and in ruin. And she was all upset because she said so many of these banks had bought these properties for nothing. And they were waiting out everybody, so to speak, before they built a redevelopment. What hit me was I have a deep love for New Orleans. And I did, you know, Katrina. I went back, you know, Sandy and all these events. I started documenting Rising Seas many, many years ago. And so I was determined to tell the story. But I felt the power of the story in the end with Katrina was in the eyes of the people. There's no way to capture the depth of what happened to these people and the scale of what happened.
Well, and that's the thing. I saw an image of a TV set buried in the sand, about three quarters buried in the sand. And what's interesting about that, even though there's not a person in that, everybody knows where that TV set belongs, on a coffee table in a living room with people watching it. You can feel the absence of life. You can feel the idea that everything was disrupted. And, you know, I had a very unusual situation, which was I had a raised home that was built on piers and not super high, but close enough to the lake that, you know, it was an 1885 house with a wraparound porch. It was a beautiful home. But they knew that the water would rise. And so when it came up, it just got to the threshold of the door. It didn't get into the house. It maybe took away the insulation, but all around it, people who built all those years later were washed out. We had a house that was survived. And it was just a few days after. At that time, my wife's friend was an aerial photographer for the movies. It was a company called Helinet. And they were the only helicopters in the air that were not part of a rescue team. So all of the footage, everything you saw on any news station, was pool footage coming from this helicopter. Like every rescue, every anything, these guys were shooting. And they were offering it to everybody, including the government, who said, we don't want to see that right now. Like, it was weird to hear. So we had rebounded out, and we found out that these helicopter pilots were like 11 guys in one room in Baton Rouge. Like, they had no place to stay. And our house was strangely survived and on a grid with a fire station. And a few days later, the services came on, and it was insane. So we lent it to this helicopter crew, and they would land their helicopters on a nearby high school football field.
That's amazing.
And then they would come over and stay at our house. We weren't there. We just, for like a month, we donated the space to them. And the local police chief would guard their helicopters with their equipment in it. And they'd wake up the next morning at daylight, and they'd be back in that helicopter. And we would hear some inside stories about unbelievable rescues and, you know, very strange things. So, you know, our being absent was our way of helping.
Oh, it was. You did a beautiful thing, man. I mean, that's an amazing story. I had never heard anything quite like that. That's an amazing story. I will tell you, what you hit on is really interesting with that photograph. I just want to share with you, that is really, for me, that was what I call, you know, almost like a post-apocalyptic image, where, you know, when I saw it, I saw it during high tide, and I saw the tip of a TV set rising out of the water. I came back at sunset and the low tide, and that's, to me, where I made the photograph, because to me, it was almost a metaphor for what I was experiencing. It was as if 6 months had passed. The media left. It went out with the tide. You know, it was like the TV set was the media. It had this strange, haunting quality to me, which reminded me of a film, you know, Planet of the Apes, where, you know, Charlton Heston is riding horseback on the beach, and you see that moment where the torch of the Statue of Liberty is rising out of the sea, and that's all that's left of New York City. And strangely enough, when I documented Hurricane Sandy from the air, I got up in the air somehow with I have a really great friend who's one of the best pilots in the country, a guy named Al Cirillo. And Al was able to jumpstart his helicopter and got me up for 3 hours right after the hurricane hit. And I'd heard rumor that there was a roller coaster that had been dragged into the Atlantic Ocean. And we flew all the way down the coast to this one area. It was the Jetstar roller coaster. And it was literally in the Atlantic Ocean. And I'll never forget the sight as we slowly banked around it. My mouth was agape because I couldn't believe that something had the physical force to grab a roller coaster and drag it into the ocean. The dock where the roller coaster had been looked like an animal, like Godzilla had come in and literally with its teeth just ripped it. And as we flew over it, the water, because so much sand had been dredged up from the actual storm, the water was turquoise and it was dead calm. And Al looked at me and he said, Stephen, I've been flying these waters for 30 years. I have never seen the water this calm, ever. And he was able to get me just low enough. And it is a post-apocalyptic image because you see this incredible, recognizable physical shape of a roller coaster sitting in this turquoise water of the Atlantic Ocean. And for me, it was another strong connection to that post-apocalyptic image.
It sounds dystopian, and yet you're living the moment behind that camera and clicking it. So it's not the future, right? That's what's strange.
It resonates with what our potential future can be. You know, there's something, what I try to do in all my work, and you've seen this, is that I try to use the power of beauty to tell sometimes some of the darkest stories that we are experiencing in our lives and what's happening in our world. So I always feel that if I can get you to look and I can access your soul through your eyes, then I have a chance to touch your soul in a way.
Well, I think you do it again in your study of burned objects, which I saw on your website. It's very beautiful and very devastating. And I don't know if that all came from one fire. You know, was there a moment when you began to study the burned objects?
When I first started in the business, I worked for many years as a commercial photographer. One of my first clients was a bank called Manufacturers Hanover. You might remember them. Anyway, they came to me with a project. They said, we want to shoot a firefighter. And I said, oh, great. Let's make some phone calls. And it was somebody in Texas. And the guy, I had this idea. I said, let's go into a burned out house. I want to do a portrait of you there. So we go into this burned out house, and it turns out the house is where a gas explosion had happened. And so everything literally melted at an extreme hot temperature, and then it extinguished like that. So I found objects that were just like 8-track cassette player that was literally liquefied and then frozen in time in that moment of heat. And I found, you know, puppets and all these things. And I had him holding one for the portrait. But that experience, you know, of just being in that physical place sparked an idea in me. When I started looking at these objects, I started to collect this stuff. I started to realize that they were like sculpture to me. And I basically collected them only as objects. You know, I never had any intention of photographing them. And fast forward almost 10 or 12 years later, I'm with my mentor and we're seeing this new camera that Polaroid came out with called the 20 by 24 Polaroid camera. And I remember I did a portrait of Jay, my mentor, on this camera, and I looked at the detail and the scale of his head, it was larger than life size. And it was a transformative moment because the detail, I started looking, I said, wait a second, if I could shoot those burned objects like this, like 20 by 24, I could make people see them the way I see them. How do you make people see what you see? And suddenly the scaling of format, being able to shoot an actual original negative that's 20 by 24, is the way I saw these burned objects. And so that started the series, basically. And I you see front and back because I couldn't decide which side I liked, so I would shoot both. And then when I would pin them on a wall, I loved the way they worked together. It became this beautiful sort of front and back story of what this object is.
I like that too. And something as simple as a plastic hanger sort of becomes almost like a nude sculpture.
It's dancing, right? Don't you feel it's lyrical? It's like the gesture. There's something about the gesture of all of these objects. And there's something about like the frozen moment of time, like something that heats something and then extinguishes like that. You've keyed into it. I hope to do a book with that work someday because I've shot like, I think I've got about 60 or 70 of them that I've done.
It was like you're the one surviving observer of Pompeii.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But it's American Pompeii, right? It is, these objects all speak about our history in a way, right? Our daily lives, you know, the alarm clock, the melted alarm clock. Well, there are all these things that they're part of our daily lives that we, you know, look up with, we grew up with, whatever. And suddenly you see them as this, like you said, in a way that they are. They're like this freeform sculpture that becomes something else.
Well, I know this is an audio-only podcast, but you have painted a picture for us through your stories. I'm so grateful that you invested the time. I want to encourage folks to find out more by going to stephenwilkes.com and look into this new version of Day to Night. It is an extraordinary book that has all these places, Central Park, Brooklyn Bridge, the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, like just magical moments that this man sat for 36 hours at a time to give us portraits of amazing places in the world. And Stephen, your eye is amazing, and I appreciate your telling the story behind all of that.
Well, thank you, Pat. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, and I hope people enjoy the work. It's a view into our lives. I think in a way it's 10, 15, 20 years from now, these pictures really will share the way we live. Enjoy, and thank you for this lovely conversation.
Thanks for joining us. We know you have many choices in the podcast universe, so we appreciate you investing the time to be a part of our creative community. Creativity in Captivity is produced by Sweetwood Creative in Austin, Texas. with support from co-producer and audio wizard Tucker Hazel. This episode was edited by the Right Honorable Tanner Dykstra. Original theme song written and sung by Maya Sharp. Additional support and technical jiggery-pokery provided by Diane Johansson and Tony Deo of Ghost Runner Records. Feel free to check out our archived episodes at creativityincaptivity.fun. You're hearing that right. It's .fun. So much fun, the punctuation can't even follow it. Ciao for now.
Staring at an empty page, stepping on a ghost-lit stage, a circus of uncertainty. Your call.